About to get started. And I'm J.C. Baldwin, President of the Port of Chelan County Board of Commissioners, and I'm calling our board to order.
I'm Keith Gannon, and as Chairman of the Chelan County Board of Commissioners, we are in session.
I'm Randy Smith, and as the President of the PUD Commission, I will call our meeting to order.
And we need to lead. Thank you very much. Could everybody please stand and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Jeff, do you want this?
I've got a lapel mic here. So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the three commissioners, and thanks to the Port District for hosting today's meeting. This is a public meeting, and a reminder that we are recording, and therefore any comments from around the table or from the audience need to be with a microphone. All of the speakers will operate from the podium up front, so just make sure you've got a microphone close to you. We do have the handheld that if there's a question or statement from the audience that we can get that microphone to you. First order of business is to quickly go around the table and in the room to identify who we have here. Commissioner Gaynor, would you like to start?
Keith Gaynor, Chelan County.
J.C. Baldwin, Port of Chelan County.
Steve Wright, Chelan PUD.
Rory Turner, Port of Chelan County.
Randy Smith, Chelan PUD.
Don Etherington, Port of Chelan County.
Doug England, Chelan County.
Dennis Bowles, Chelan County PUD.
Ron Walter, Chelan County.
Carna Bourbon, Chelan PUD.
Gary Arsenault, Chelan PUD.
Ann Congdon, Chelan PUD.
Mark Herdahl, Executive Director, Port of Chelan County.
Next over here.
Josh Wyland, Alcoa.
Skip Morehouse, City of Chelan.
Trent Moyer, Kingborn Airport Director.
Keith Rayburn, City of Antioch.
Jeff Gordon, City of Cashman.
Mike Cooney, City of Chelan.
Joel Walensky, City of Leavenworth.
Sherry Farivar, City of Leavenworth.
Steve McKenna, Citizen of Leavenworth.
Andrew Waddell, Chelan PUD. Kelly
Boyd, Chelan PUD.
Tracy Young, Chelan PUD. Kirk Hudson, Chelan PUD.
Teresa Boucher, Chelan PUD. Tika Sellers, Chelan PUD.
Dan Fraser, Chelan PUD.
John Soles, Eric Baldwin.
Judy Bradford,
Port
County. Bradford,
Port
County.
David Reblog, representing Senator Maria Campbell.
Frank Coates, City of Wenatchee.
Craig Larson, Port of Chelan County.
Gail Thursday,
Gail Chelan. Suzanne Hart.
And that's everybody. We have a new one that came in. Okay, Christine, thank you. And Shiloh makes an entrance.
Yep.
Welcome.
Yep.
Again, welcome to this afternoon's meeting of the Chelan County Tri-Commission. The first order of business on the agenda is the affordable housing shortage, and Mayor Kuntz will start with that. And Mayor, again, ask you to use the microphone. There's a podium mic up there. Right up there.
And I think I shut it off, Frank.
Is it this one?
Yeah.
Look at that.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for giving me and the other mayors who are going to join me, I think, soon, a few minutes to talk about. Agenda says affordable housing. I'm just going to use housing in a general sense because we need all kinds of housing. We need affordable housing. We need multifamily units. We need anything with a roof and flushing toilet, I think. The city has commissioned a housing study. You guys have just a quick brief part of it. It's not in final form yet. The actual study itself is a couple hundred pages. You just have 8 or 10 pages of notes, some stuff that I'll go over in terms of what some of the numbers are showing. And I think it confirms what we already know and what the other mayors will tell you. So we have a terrible shortage of housing. I would say in our county. This study is done within the urban areas defined by the federal government, so it includes Wenatchee, East Wenatchee, Malaga, Rock Island, and the Sunny Slope area. So that's the study that they've put in front of you. And that, there's a, page 3 or 4 has that on there. And, you know, what we already know, right? Housing prices are going up roughly 5.5% a year for each of the last 4 years. So if you can do multiplication, that's 20-some percent in the last 4 years. Rental rates somewhat higher than that, but almost 6% a year for the last 4 years. So up some 24%. I mean, those kinds of things. And think of what inflation's doing, right? What's inflation? 2% a year? 1.5% a year? Not very much. So what we're finding is more and more of a person's household income is going to housing. Roughly a third of the populace in our in this region is spending more than 30% of their monthly income on housing. So that's money that's not being spent in the retail, not being spent in other sectors, and is really causing a bit of a problem. I thought some of the most interesting things, and I can't tell what page we're on, pages 5 and 6, when you look at the median value of a single-family resident, and you compare Wenatchee at $256,000 to Yakima at $150,000 and Spokane at $180,000 and even the Tri-Cities at $210,000 or $220,000. Now, what does that mean for our region? When you're a school teacher and your beginning salaries are the same in all of those locations, where are you going to go to work? What if you're a nurse? Same sorts of issues. I'm on the board of Confluence Health, and I get yelled at all the time by the board members for saying this, but we continue to be on diversion, not for a lack of bed space. It's for a lack of nurses. The reason we don't have nurses, they can't find a place to live. They'll come in, they'll work 2 or 3 days, I'm out of here, can't find a place to live. That affects all of us. And it's interesting as you, and you can look at the median value and look at the bottom tier numbers on page 6 are telling you the exact same thing. And then page 7 tells you about the square foot price per house. Vacancy rates at about 1%. You know, the consultant says we need somewhere around 1,000 new units. He's got some in the residential, single family, and some in the apartments. I think we need probably at least 1,500 new units. One of the things that's interesting that this study will show you is, and I'll get the numbers a little bit off, I want to say, you know, 35% of our households are 1- and 2-person households, yet a majority of our building stock are 3- and 4-bedroom homes. So we're not hitting what the people need in this area. We keep building 3- and 4-bedroom homes when the demand is. And how do you see that? Look at Riverside 9, right? 1- and 2-bedroom and studios and full, absolutely full. So again, the median monthly rent, over $900 a month. Vacancy rates, again, under 1%. And there's a bunch of stuff in here that talks about new home production, and you can see on some of the graphs where the Riverside 9 came in. And so I guess the issue for me is, you know, what can we do to fix some of this stuff? So here's some things that the city has been thinking about doing. First of all, the apartment developer, and this is all public information, has purchased 4 acres down along the waterfront where the city had the, or Apple Blossom had the carnival last year, that 4-acre block between Columbia Valley Brewing and so he'll be in hopefully next year, build 120 to 140 units in there, which will help. That's a start. One of the things that we've been approached, and I can't say anything other than we've been approached about actually surplusing some city property that we're currently using for different use to help for housing. I think the city's probably going to do that. They're looking really hard at, would you surplus a piece of property that's better used as housing than what is currently being used? I think all of us in this room, either on the board you're on, control property that might be better used for housing at some point in time. And I think we all need to start thinking about, if we're going to put our money where our mouth is, should we start doing some of those things? The other thing that's been, and staff and I have talked about this quite a bit the last couple of days, you know, the old motto, you just wait for developers to pay for everything, right? City's not in the middle of this. Developer pay for the road, developer pay for the sewer extension, developer pay for water, pay for sidewalks. But what do you get? Right now, you don't have a lot going on. And so we've talked about as the city, maybe it's time for us to put our money where our mouth is. Maybe we got to start paying for infrastructure. Maybe we got to start paying for roads and sidewalks and get an inventory of property ready to go. So when these developers come to town, we have something to show them. I'll go out tomorrow and start chasing developers. I don't have an inventory of land to go show them. It's got water, sewer, all the infrastructure that you need and is zoned and ready to go. I don't have it on this side of the river, not very much at all. So we really got to start, I think, thinking about other things that we can do. We're going to look at our code and talk about what we can do with infill. Can we do it better? You know, we've got some odd-shaped lots that our code probably prohibits smaller homes on. We got to look at that. Our code right now prohibits the tiny houses. Is that what we call those? So in our code, that's not allowed. So we're going to relook at that to see if we can get some other sorts of housing things to work on. And, you know, other thing we've done, and we don't have the final results of this, but we did look at the other entities around and look at what it costs for building permits between, say, Wenatchee, Chelan County, East Wenatchee, Douglas County. Those kinds of things are about the same, quite frankly, if you look at all of the different jurisdictions that do that. Where things get a little different is the utility hookup fees. And in some instances, some folks that have utilities, those numbers are really higher than other jurisdictions. And so I think to the extent that we can look at some of those, if we're going to help, I think government has to be involved. We can't sit there and wait for the developers to be the ones that drive all that. So, and I know it's a regional problem. I'd like the other mayors to come up, if you could, and tell us a little bit about what's going on in Leavenworth. I know Chelan and Cashmere and any at all, at least when we've talked, I think have the same problem. And I want to believe 300 housing units in Chelan helps Wenatchee, right? 300 housing units in Cashmere helps the Wenatchee Valley, as they would in Leavenworth and Enneat. I mean, all the people ride the link bus up and down, and I just think we need to continue to try to figure out how to make this region a better place for housing and start dealing with, to have the highest housing, median housing price in all of Eastern Washington is just beyond me. So we got to do something about it. Mayors, come up. Bail me out.
Thank you, Frank. I'm Sherry Farivar, Mayor of Leavenworth. And we have such a serious affordable housing, or let's just say housing shortage right now, that I've put together an affordable housing or housing affordability task force made up of about 14 people from various walks of life, trying to come up with just some great ideas to increase the housing supply in Leavenworth. You know, there's an issue with affordable housing, but then there's an overarching issue with just housing in general. Frank talked about the median price range in Wenatchee being, did you say 256?
Yeah.
In Leavenworth, it's $330,000. And I think it's important for you to recognize that this is, yes, Leavenworth's an attractive place to live. There's a lot of demand there. But what we don't have is any supply. We have almost no new houses going in all the time. Right at the moment, we have a new subdivision, 37 lots coming online in the next month or so. Or they'll begin to do pre-sales of that. And a few other small plats of 4 lots, 5 lots, even up to 7 lots. However, what we don't have is, like in Wenatchee, in Wenatchee there's a really vibrant spec housing market where builders build houses for people to buy. We don't have that in Leavenworth. And part of the reason is the cost. And part of the reason is the uncertainty of the Leavenworth market. Because there are no builders building homes there, other builders are a little wary to come there and to start building homes for spec. A 30%, we're 30% higher, our median house price for the whole 98826 zip code, which also includes Plain, Lake Wenatchee, and Peshaston. They have a different zip code, but they're in the same MLS area. Although our housing, our median house price is $330,000 as compared to $156 in Yakima and $187 in Spokane and two in the $250s in the Wenatchee East, Wenatchee Marketplace, Guess what? Our teachers make the same amount of money as they do in Wenatchee. Our nurses make the same amount of money as they do in Wenatchee. Everybody in any kind of profession has to look at where can they get the best bang for their buck, and it's not Leavenworth. What we're seeing in Leavenworth is kind of an unnatural number of vacation homes where people are buying into the Leavenworth dream for their weekend home, and maybe they'll retire there, that kind of thing. So we're dealing with a lot of issues, including infrastructure, that are very very difficult for a population of 1,978 people. So although Leavenworth might be the biggest little city in Washington, it is a tiny city. And we only have a footprint for the city of Leavenworth of 1.36 square miles. So really very small. Something we're dealing with is annexations and how to deal with those, stretching out our infrastructure. And, you know, although we are somewhat prosperous in Leavenworth, you have to recognize that the cost of infrastructure is really pretty much way above our heads. So one of the things I want to leave you with is a comment from two of the members on my Housing Affordability Task Force. And Steve McKenna's here as a representative of our task force, and thank you for coming today, Steve. The biggest thing that seems to be an issue in Leavenworth is that there's nowhere to rent. So people who move into Leavenworth are having to pay incredible, exorbitant amounts for a tiny house, small house, or even an apartment. Some of the reports I've heard, anecdotally, I don't have real evidence of this yet, but is that there are two-bedroom apartments in Leavenworth renting from $1,500 a month to $2,000 a month, and houses renting up to $3,000 a month. So obviously, those are bigger than most people's house payments. And so it's very difficult to be a young family, try to find a place to live, and save up for a down payment in our area. So again, that's a supply and demand issue. What we need is supply. Enough said. Mike, are you next?
Could be.
Thank you. I have a little problem. We picked you up on here. Oh, I want to make sure we're good here. Oh, it wasn't on. Did anybody have a hard time hearing me?
I think I was picking you up here.
Is this also our discussion time that we do? Okay. Well, to tag on to about the affordable housing, I think each of the five different municipalities within Chelan County have five very distinctly different things. If you picture Chelan, we're right now in a very serious discussion as to how do we limit housing tracts, people coming in and taking orchards and putting in 40 homes, 50 homes, and changing the landscape of Lake Chelan. So we're a little different in that we're having that discussion. We're going into a comp plan review, and we've hired Burke Consulting to take public comment as to what do they want Chelan to look like 20 years from now. So that's on one end. And it all came about from one development that is putting in 99 homes that carved out a hillside. And you hear a lot of people that have lived there forever really disliking that. And while being mayor, I don't want to see that valley change from beautiful hillsides to Burien, and no knock on Burien if you're from Burien. So that's on one end, but on the other end, we talk about affordable housing, or we talk about there's different areas in our town that have low rents. That also are certain areas that we also have the most amount of police activity in those areas. So it's a really hard balance, and I don't know the answer to it. But when we have people with homes within the downtown area renting at the lowest rate, we typically are having an infill of issues that you pretty much don't want to have in your city. More calls for drugs or domestic abuse, and those are things, mainly the drugs. And so So I'm always caught as to what we need, and what I've come up with, and I think our council is really working hard on it, is we're looking at two certain areas. I've said this before, out of Namas or Apple Blossom area, we have 1 to 200 acres that we're going to be taking out of warehouse industrial and put into affordable housing area that will be able to do communities, that will be able to put gardens in, will be able to put activities, whether it's a soccer pitch or something, and a community that regulates itself in that manner. The other area is at the airport, and I kind of had a theme, the good, the bad, and the not, or the could be really good, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. I'll talk about the bad. We took one, if you know Chelan at all, behind the Shell station, there's the white apartments, and forever they've been an eyesore. They've been affordable housing. They rent for around $300 to $400 a month. There's been 16 families living in those, and it's kind of always full. Well, it's also attracted a lot of nuisances, so we went after it vigorously. We've had 3 meetings with the owner, and we've now come to the conclusion that we've given them a certain deadline. There's 16 families. There are 8 left in that, and we're helping relocate them. The owner's paying a relocation fund. But where do they go? I mean, where do you find 16 apartments or homes for these people that are getting? So anyway, the building will be, the bad part of it is that there's going to be people out for a very short time period. We're trying, working hard to find them homes. The good part of it is that it'll be a brand new, the owner is committed to completely stripping it down and having units back onto the market within a year's time. So I think that's a really good thing. I don't know how many people know what I'm talking about as far as the white apartments, but they're an eyesore in the middle of downtown, and so that will be changed because of our code enforcement. People have gone after it with a vigor. We did have the Regency Manor is sold, and now down here, all those 54 beds, 56 beds are now down in Wenatchee, and the new owner has withstood the pressures of selling it. He got it at a good deal, and he is not going to sell it, and the two other people wanted to do townhomes in them. He's going to do 26 units that will be 700 square feet, and the rents will be $750. So in our market, that's incredible. People cannot find a decent place to live for, I think you were talking about $1,100, $1,200. That's the same numbers for us. Usually we have the workers at Campbell's, the workers at different bars, restaurants, et cetera, kind of bunk up and pitch their money together just to be able to live in one place. The could-be-good part is we are working with many people in the audience right here as far as the water line to the airport. There are 14 flat acres that we could do housing there, but we are looking that also for light industry, so please don't take away that it would only be housing. I wanted to address Frank's thing about housing. That is an area that we can put housing, and more than just the 14 acres, there are neighboring orchards that someday might be able to give us more land. We just have a very small inventory of flat buildable land in Chelan to make it happen. So I'll leave you with the good. The good is that we're starting the process of a discussion. Probably doesn't mean much to you unless you come and like walking on our bridge, but with the help of Jeff Wilkins and his staff, we are working with the council and with the public to one-way our old historic bridge into town, widening the sidewalks, making the entrance of town more pedestrian-friendly. And that's not anything to do with affordable housing, but that will be a nice entryway into town, and it's right now will be before City Council next meeting as far as the traffic study that we'll undertake as far as what impacts that will have on the thing. So the old bridge safety has been a big thing for Chelan. means a lot to the people that live in Chelan and visit Chelan, and I strongly feel that it will be something really cool that you'll be able to see 8-foot-wide sidewalk on the up lake and five-wide sidewalk on the other side. And I'm just going to leave it with this. October 7th, we're having a open house at 5 o'clock, 5 to 7, and we could talk about affordable housing, but it will be a going-away party for Paul Schmidt, a dear friend and one heck of a great city administrator. He's leaving. He's retiring, and we're going to have... So if you've done any business with Paul, you know what a great, upstanding man. And I'm making it a point within the city of Chelan, if you've ever complained to Paul, you have to come and shake his hand. Thank you. Jeff, are you up next? Thanks for your time.
Well, I'm going to be quite brief relative to the previous speakers. Kashmir has a unique problem with our newer subdivisions. We have one, lots are $120,000. What's happening is these are being purchased and built on by people outside the area. So they're not moving from a less expensive home in Kashmir to those newer homes. That's bringing people in from outside the area, and there are no less expensive homes available because of that. The second thing, and my perception was this was a Leavenworth and a Chelan problem. On my block in the past year, two homes have been sold to people from the west side as second homes. That's done two things. That's taken two homes away from availability for local residents and people that work in Kashmir. And the second thing is it's done is it's raised the one of those was sold at more than the asking price. That has raised our assessed value for the improvements 33% on that block. So our homes have become less affordable because of that. These are just some unique things that people don't think about that have become obvious to me in looking at this housing problem. Keith?
Thanks, Jeff. I'll be real quick, too. Annette, and I like the second what Frank said about infrastructure. We have 200 acres of orchard in the city limits of Annette, and so we have land, but they don't have any infrastructure and stuff. We are really growing, actually. We're getting a lot of people coming in. Houses are being built, but they're not affordable. They're upscale. I just signed in a contract yesterday with the Housing Authority of Chelan County to build 30 to 35 units of affordable housing. And there's a waiting list for them already, and we haven't started building them yet. We are a bedroom community of Wenatchee. I have a group, like all the mayors, we have committees going and trying to see what we can do, and they're finding that we have a lot of people in Annette that work in Wenatchee, that live in Annette. We have a lot of people who live in Annette, work in Chelan, and I just found out yesterday we have 5 people who live in Annette that work in Leavenworth, and they travel every day, so... I like to second what all the other mayors are saying. Things are happening, but they're not happening at the right level. We just got 2 houses that are being built, and they're in the $700,000 range on the waterfront. And again, these are going to be vacation homes, we believe, so we're trying to figure out what to do with those. But whatever we can do, we need to do something. We have a lot of people. School contacted me yesterday. They have several new teachers, 5 of them are young ladies, first-year teachers, and we have a group trying to figure out if we can get some homes or someplace they can stay for a while. There's no apartments, there's no place to rent. And what's available, you know, I wouldn't put my dog or horse in any of those buildings, so we really need to do something. Thank you.
Thanks, Keith, and thanks to the other mayors. I'd be willing to entertain any questions if anybody had any questions for us. If not, I just look forward to working with not only the port, but the PUD and then our friends at Chelan County Commissioners on things that we can do as the ones that control the taxpayer money and what we can do to help alleviate some of these issues. So Thank you for giving us a half hour of your time. Hopefully we're within our time limits. I don't know if we were or weren't, but, you know.
Commissioners, any comments or thoughts?
Great. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mayors. Appreciate that. Next on the agenda is future of the Alcoa work group, and we have representatives of the work group here. Tracy Hunt is going to lead that part of the discussion.
Come on up. Come on up. Quick introduction, Tracy Young with Schlein PUD. I've been serving with Sarah Rolfs as the co-facilitator for the Alcoa work group. And a little more? Is that better? Okay. So we wanted to come and give an update of what's been happening and make some recommendations going forward. And Josh Weiland is here from Alcoa. He's going to give a little update, and then we're going to go down the line here and give some status of what we've been working on and also what we've learned from some other communities. So here you go.
Thanks, Tracy, and thanks, everybody, for having me here today. Again, Josh Weiland with Alcoa. I cover public and government affairs for Alcoa in the Northwest, and I appreciate the opportunity to come in. I'm happy to entertain questions today. If it's of value, we're happy to send me or somebody else over again to make sure that there's representation from Alcoa here. And I'll make one note that Steve and I were talking before we got started here, and you've had, I think, a positive conversation with Simon Baker, who is the president of Alcoa's energy group. And so if there's something that I'm missing here, please feel free to interject or follow up afterwards. So the two updates that I have for you today, one is regarding the status of the Wenatchee Works plant, and that is simply this, that there really is there's no update to give. The plant is still curtailed, and really no decision has been made regarding a possible restart at this time. So that's update number one. Probably not a huge surprise to the group, but wanted to be able to deliver it in person. The second is addressing concerns about the company's separation and the assignment of Wenatchee's power contract to a separate LLC. So there's a tremendous amount of changes going on right now as Alcoa prepares to separate into two standalone companies this year. The assignment of the power contract to the proper legal entity, to the Wenatchee LLC, is a requirement of the separation. It's happening all across our business on a number of fronts, and it would be happening whether Wenatchee were curtailed or running. So when the company separates, Alcoa Inc. will no longer be the owner of Wenatchee's assets, as Alcoa Inc. will become the new Arconic Corporation, or the downstream corporation of the business. So the transfer of the contract is necessary in that sense. And one point to emphasize is that the external credit support that covers Chelan PUD today will have external credit support to cover Chelan PUD post-separation as well. So in that respect, nothing will change, and Chelan's interests will be protected from a neutral manner. And with that, that's really the update from Alcoa. And again, Steve, if you have anything to add there from your conversations with Simon, please feel free. And I'm also happy to entertain any questions.
So I'll just add one thing. I think we were concerned, certainly, about the split of the company and the separation of the LLC. And the primary issue is we have a big contract, and we want to know the creditworthiness of the counterparty that we're dealing with. I think the thing that I felt good about in terms of the conversation with Simon Baker was what we were looking for was a commitment that at the end of the day, after this split takes place, contractual modifications will be made that leave us in a position of being neutral, and we would say, or positive, to the split. Alcoa, Simon would commit to neutral, which is certainly appropriate given his position. So when you start from that principle, then you're now working towards what will it take in order to be able to effectuate that. So we have work to do there. But we're starting from the right principle, and we feel good about that.
Echoed here. Agreed. Happy to take any questions or turn it over to Susan. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Hi, I'm Susan Adams, and I work for SkillSource, and I've had the privilege over the last 10 months partnering with Employment Security, Wenatchee Valley College, and the Washington State Labor Council with the folks that were affected by the layoff. And so I guess with that being said, I'm giving the people update. So each of us kind of have a section that we're giving the people, future, and plant. So the three different areas. So we've been partnering together since last November to help serve the almost 425 individuals laid off at the plant. And we've been able to assist them with rapid response, career and employment assistance, and then all the other benefits available through Trade Act, worker retraining, and dislocated worker programs. And as of last week, just some numbers, and these numbers are always changing and evolving because many of the individuals we are still serving and will be serving for probably up to 2 to 3 more years, depending on the training plan that they have chosen. But as of last week, we were able to account for about 364 of the 412 that we have been tracking and working with. Of those, 35 have retired. Another 28 are currently receiving subpay and are anticipated to retire. 116 of those are employed, ranging from jobs that are they're earning, most of them, anywhere from $16 to $30 an hour, and a variety of positions from heavy equipment operator, fleet services supervisor, union steward, project foreman. So it's a wide variety of positions. Some of these individuals have relocated to other areas in these positions, not a large amount. I don't have an exact number, but I would say probably somewhere between 10 and 20 have relocated. Some of them have taken positions with Intalco in Ferndale, and we've helped them with relocation. Another 154 are in school or in some type of training. Another 28 are researching school and plan to attend. Of those 154 that are currently in training, 96 are attending Wenatchee Valley College in programs from machining to HVAC, welding, computer technology. Another 11 are in 1 to 2 year tech schools such as Perry Tech. Some people have gone out of the area. Another 43 are in certificate programs such as CDL, lineman, heavy equipment, so a variety there as well. And we know 4 that are currently pursuing a 4-year degree. I also just wanted to touch on, because I know recently there was some press related to the Trade Act program and individuals not getting their income support once their unemployment insurance was exhausted. And both at the local and state level, Employment Security has worked really hard to bring those people up to speed in getting their income support. And so we feel that they're on track to now be supported as they were promised with the Trade Act program. And so with that, that's an update.
And who's going? Thank you.
I'll ask for some help, maybe with my handout here. I'll just pass this one. Sorry. Good afternoon. I'm Kelly Boyd. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Chelan PUD, and I'm doing the plant portion of this update. So while the handouts are coming around, I just wanted to start by giving a quick overview of the current contract between the Chelan PUD and Alcoa. And the current contract was signed in 2008. It became effective in 2011. As part of the negotiations at that time, we recognized the value that Alcoa brings to the community through their family wage jobs and all the local economic benefit that comes along with that. And as part of that, we also designed the contract in a manner that encourages operation of the Wenatchee Works plant, because that's how the community gets those benefits through the operations of the plant. So you'll hear those themes as I give my update of how things are going now. So turning to the second page, or I guess your second slide, there's more than one on a page. Here's how the contract works. Alcoa receives 26% of the output of Rocky Reach and Rock Island dams. So if it's a good water year and there's lots of generation, that number is higher than if it's a drier year and there's less generation. So their output varies depending on the actual generation. And at the beginning of the contract, some of the charges that were part of that contract were actually deferred and not due at that point in time as part of the recognizing of the value that Alcoa brings to the community. And so as part of that, that power that they get can only be used at the Wenatchee Works plant. So tying a lot of these things together of how the contract encourages operation of the Wenatchee plant. And it's a cost-plus contract, which means Alcoa pays the actual costs of operations and maintenance and debt service. And then in addition to that, they also pay additional charges for capital and debt reduction. So these are on top of the actual costs. So that means if the costs operate the dams goes up, Alcoa's amount they pay goes up, and vice versa. So as I mentioned, the contract encourages the operation of the Wenatchee Works plant. So that amount that was deferred, that was would have ordinarily been due at the beginning of the contract, was deferred, and Alcoa earns that amount over time as they operate the plant. So the concept is recognizing the value that they bring earns that charge down over time as the plant operates and their local community jobs. But if the plant isn't operating, then those charges become due. So that encourages the continuous operation to earn those charges rather than have cash flow with those charges. Although, as we know now, the plant is shut down. So how do those deferred charges encourage restart now that they did have to make that tough decision to shut down? It's because the amounts that become due are smaller the sooner the plant restarts. So there's a variety of charges, but one of the first charges that comes into play is called the initial shutdown amount. And it's prorated over time, the first 12 months of shutdown. So the sooner Alcoa can start, the smaller that payment is. So the total payment is just over $8 million. So as an example, let's say Alcoa has only shut down 6 months. So 6 of 12 months is half of the year. So half of that charge would be due. So if they're shut down, though, the whole 12 months, the full just over $8 million would be due. So there's encouragement to start up as soon as possible so that that fee is as small as possible. After time passes for that charge, the next charge to consider is called the shutdown settlement amount. When I talked about there were charges that were deferred that were owed at the beginning of the contract that are deferred, that's what this amount relates to. And if Alcoa stayed shut down for 18 months, the full amount that hasn't been earned over time by operating becomes due. So using the current shutdown circumstances as our example, 18 months of the shutdown would be the middle of 2017. So if Alcoa doesn't restart by that time, then the unearned portion of that deferred charge becomes due. And in this example, that would be $67 million. So that's a pretty good incentive to want to avoid that charge and want to restart the plant. And then that provision also has it if there's a second shutdown of any duration, that whatever the unearned portion of that charge is at that time also becomes due. So another really good incentive to restart and stay operating. There are also some other contractual provisions that encourage restart, but those are the primary ones right now. And another often asked question, moving on to the next slide, is what happens to the power while Alcoa is idle? And while the plant is idle and not using that power, it's still Alcoa's power. And Alcoa still has to pay for that power. So we don't have the opportunity to, say, take that power and sell it to another company that might want to come in. As long as that contract is in place, that is Alcoa's power, but they also pay the cost of that. So how it works is we sell the power in the market on Alcoa's behalf, and then we use those proceeds to offset the cost that I mentioned of where they pay the actual cost of operations plus a couple other charges. And if there's anything left over after applying those proceeds, then the PUD will keep that. And if there's any shortfall, then Alcoa will make up the difference. So this protects our customers of those costs during this time, that Alcoa does cover all of those costs. And in addition to that, as further protection, as Josh mentioned, we also hold a letter of credit from Alcoa to cover the charges that I mentioned and 3 months of operations. Moving on to the next slide. This gives some perspective of, you know, as we understand it, one of the key drivers for the plant to restart is the global price of aluminum. So I have a two-year snapshot. The price of aluminum, just like the price of electricity and the price of other things that you deal with, fluctuates up and down all the time. But over the last couple-year period, the trending has definitely been on more that downward trend. 2 years ago, the price of aluminum was over $2,000 a metric ton. At the time that Alcoa made the decision to shut down, it was near $1,400 a metric ton. If we just estimate an average amount of production at the plant times the difference in those prices, that's a value shift of about just over $70 million. So you can see the magnitude of the price variance that can have on the value of the plant's production. So while prices have rebounded a little bit recently, they still haven't rebounded to their previous levels or to that amount that we understand is necessary for Alcoa to make that restart decision. And as Josh mentioned, in addition to working with the Wenatchee plant and restarting that, Alcoa is also working on splitting into the two separate entities, Alcoa Corp and Arconic Inc. It's our understanding that that's targeted to be completed by about the end of the year, sometime in the fourth quarter of this year. And as part of that split, there's been the new entity created, Wenatchee Works LLC, where the Wenatchee Works plant is. So somehow in this transaction, our contract that I described would be assigned to the new entity. And we're asking for more information and that type of thing to figure out the best way to make this transaction or this assignment work. And we're working with Alcoa to make sure that we have a good way to resolve this issue. And as Steve said, our focus is to ensure that the splitting into two companies and the assignment of the contracts has a neutral or positive impact on our customers. So my last slide is the really important points that I'd like everyone to take away from this update. And they are that the contract is designed to encourage operation of the Wenatchee Works so that we can provide those jobs and community benefits. The contract does provide financial protection for the PUD customer owners in the event of a shutdown like this, whether it's short-term or long-term. The future of the plant is, as we understand it, primarily dependent on the global price of aluminum, and that's really hard to predict of what will happen with that. But we do support restart and serve and will serve the plant consistent with our contractual agreements, and we are also focused on our customers and the community to have a neutral impact from the split of Alcoa into two companies. So are there any individual questions maybe for me around the plant update?
Yeah, does the contract define what constitutes a minimum restart that would, say, prevent Alcoa from incurring these penalty charges?
It does. There are multiple levels of restart and amount of time that you have to be operating at that level to kick into restart mode. And there are various levels of restart, and the provisions are the higher the usage or the more lines that are restarted, the smaller the related charges. So similar to ongoing operations, how things work, the more operations, the smaller charges.
Have the surplus sales covered the obligations to date?
Oh, thank you for asking me that, because I did mean to mention that. Currently, the proceeds, just like aluminum prices are low, electric prices are low. So the proceeds have not been adequate to cover the cost of operations, and Alcoa has been paying that shortfall. As you go through the year, there's more generation too, and in the summer when the river is low, there's less generation to sell. So we do envision that later in the year when the flows pick up and there's more generation, that it's possible that the costs will cover and maybe be a little surplus. But by looking at the combination of costs and electric prices, we don't know that there would be a big surplus differential there.
And a follow-up question, is there a point of termination at some point in time past the 18 months? And what happens after the 18-month period expires?
So after the 18-month period expires and those charges become due, the contract still continues to exist. And it would be in the same manner where Alcoa is still responsible to pay the full cost and make up any shortfalls. And the credit provisions for protections for PUD customers still exist, so the contract can continue, but there are termination provisions for the PUD to terminate the contract, but it's at the PUD's choice, not Alcoa's.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next up, future.
Good afternoon. My name is Shiloh Schauer. I'm the Executive Director of the Rancho Valley Chamber of Commerce. And I actually want to start by thanking all of you as part of the Tri-Commission for establishing the work group in November, for bringing together the resources and staff people to discuss what, unfortunately, is a very difficult topic for our community. But the discussions have been very fruitful. And really, I think, has allowed not only us as organizations in this community that are working on economic development get a better understanding of all the wonderful assets that are here, but also being realistic about what we need to potentially do to respond to a host of Alcoa outcomes. And so that wouldn't have happened if Commissioner Walter didn't stand up on November 3rd and said, hey, and good old Mark Erdl over there didn't say, well, we should probably help with that, and the rest of us got together. So thank you for that opportunity. The future is really a big question mark, but we are going to continue to do a few key things as we respond not only to what we're hearing from the community through the Our Valley What's Next process, which is creating more resiliency to a variety of business cycles that can occur in our region as we're connected to commodity markets on a global scale across the world, but also to look at what is next for us as a region to create a more prosperous and vibrant and diverse economy. So the first things that's connected to us, which the chamber will be leading with the thanks of the good senator, we were connected to a gentleman by the name of Guy Barrett. He works for the Department of Ecology. He was able to oversee and work with the closure and cleanup for the site for the Longview site. And so we want to get a little more educated about the state's process, and that was suggested to us when we spoke with some of communities similar to ours that have gone through this. And so the chamber is arranging a call with Guy in the latter part of September. There'll be some other community members that deal with economic development connected to that call, just to understand, should the worst outcome happen for us, what as a community do we need to do to be prepared? The other thing that we have found in this process that would be important, because we have a change in leadership coming in some of our elected offices, and we have some new folks that are here that have never had the opportunity to tour the facility. Alcoa, I'm working with their environmental manager, Dave, is it Holse?
Holse.
Yep. He is working with me to do a tour of the Alcoa facility for a small group of folks in October. And so some of the electeds that are new to the area that may become newly elected to the county commission seat and other economic development entities who've never seen the facility, it's quite impressive. We will be doing that. And one of the reasons we're doing that is because we still have an invitation from the legislature to potentially make an ask. When we testified before the Senate Ways and Means Committee on the state's response to large-scale layoffs and closures like this, they gave us an opportunity. We said, can we hold a spot? We don't know what we need yet for our community. And as this situation continues to evolve, there may be an ask out of it. It could be additional worker retraining opportunities for folks. It could be helping Alcoa make that restart again. It could, who knows? We just don't know what that ask is yet. But also understanding what's out there in terms of facilities and other opportunities for us to maybe attract additional industry that would complement that facility is important. So that will be happening in October, the tour, and then we'll see what comes of an ask, if there is one to be made during the next legislative session. So lastly, I just want to thank Tracy Yont and Steve Wright and many others who have really been helpful in helping us see what it might take for all of us as a community to prepare for a whole host of outcomes that are coming. And a big thank you to Josh for being here today on behalf of Alcoa. It's important. I've seen David out quite a few times in the community, still having a presence on behalf of Alcoa as they try to figure out what's going to happen for their company and for our community. So a big thank you to all of you. And I think that's all I have. Did I forget anything? No? Okay, good.
Any questions for Shiloh? Maybe my question either for Shiloh or Josh, but I'm just kind of curious, in other plants that have been shut down, is there any kind of a conversion potential? Has it been converted to some other facility that may fit for here? Or has it just been a total dismantling?
Sorry, my foot fell asleep. Thanks for your question. I actually work with our asset management group on all of our remediation sites in the Northwest, and so I'd be happy to, yes, the answer is yes, and I'd be happy to talk with you after the meeting. That works best. Sure.
Josh, can I ask you a question real quick?
Yep.
My understanding, the plan when we take up 100 or 200 acres, you know, Alcoa might have a couple of thousand acres of land out there. Any thoughts of what to do with excess property out there?
Yes. So I probably can't offer much more than I've said up here today, but let's connect either during the meeting or after the meeting, and be happy to get you some answers. Absolutely.
Just a quick question for Josh, if I may.
You're not going anywhere.
No. I don't need a microphone. So you'd rather not discuss remediation? That's something you want to do offline? I'm just curious the timeline for other communities, other facilities that have shut down in terms of how long the remediation, environmental cleanup and remediation took.
Well, I can certainly answer questions about other facilities, but the status of the Wenatchee plant is still very sure. much the same. It's curtailed, not shut down, not
right.
closed, and no decision has been made yet on what's next.
I'm just curious about remediation at other plants around the country that have shut down. Does it take a long time? Is it a five-year process? Has it been a 20-year process?
It all depends on the site.
Yeah. Okay.
So I can talk to you offline
All
about
right.
it for sure.
Thanks.
And Commissioner Congdon, part of what we're going to be talking to Guy about in the September call is there's a process the state goes through, and there's a community element to that process should that be the path that eventually happens here. And so we want to get the best information so we understand that. And we also, I think Tracy's going to share a little bit about other opportunities that came to other communities and how they addressed it. But I don't anticipate it would be an immediate thing. I mean, it is definitely a process. And the more we can have a plan, I think that's important for our community. And that's why the work that's been done so far, I think, has been advantageous to us so far to date. So.
Yeah, getting to that a little bit. Another thing the work group did is we reached out to other communities, tried to learn what they went through. And we focus on people, plant, and future. And so they shared some things, and that was going to be part of my closing, was to convey to this group what we learned as part of those community discussions. First, that site use and operations prior to cleanup but post-shutdown should be, the decisions for that should be informed by the community. One of the communities said, boy, we'd really like our port to have more of a say of what happened with the facility rather than this other user coming in and perhaps causing more damage environmentally or whatever. So their recommendation was is if the plant does shut down and they are looking for another user or another function, is to try to figure out how the community can be part of that decision-making process. So that was point one. Another point was the approach to cleanup of the site is largely influenced by the approach of the owner. We reached out to the Dalles and Longview, and now this is input back from the community. So their view was, in one situation, they had an owner that was really proactive, and so they were able to deal at the state level, and they got it done. I think the number was like from shutdown to cleanup was like 5 years. Now, again, site conditions vary from site to site, but that sounded, wow, that's pretty optimistic. Another site owner wasn't as motivated, for lack of a better term, and it ended up needing to go through a Superfund site, which created a much longer duration, you know, tens of years rather than 5 years time frame. So their perspective was the cleanup duration and the process was largely dependent on the motivation and how the owner approached it. The third point was community can either move on or hold on. One of them, the Dalles, they prepared for the future. They thought about, well, we're not going to stop restart, right? If it happens, it happens. But we're going to go out and we're going to think about a future without aluminum in our community. So kind of serendipity, but, you know, Google was looking for a home. And since then, they've hired a lot of people. They put in infrastructure and created another resource revenue for their community. Longview, on contrast, their community really tried to hold on. They wanted to get their aluminum facility back up and running, and their sense was that they didn't branch out, they didn't look and do other things, and it really took some time for that community to move on afterwards. So those are the three points, is participate where you can in the use of the site, the approach of the site owner towards cleanup influences the process and timeline, and third is the community can either move on or hold on. So there's been a lot of work done. You know, we got together to share information. We got together to learn things and communicate back with this group. But we are, the Alcoa Work Group was kind of a rapid response group. Shiloh and I were talking one day. We kind of felt like it's a rapid response. It's not something maybe that lasts forever. And so what we were going to do in this meeting was recommend that we're going to continue to share information, but pause our regular staff meetings until a point in the future where it makes sense, maybe we get back together. But essentially pause our work and then let the individual groups that are working on people, working on the future, and then the PUD working with the Alcoa on at least the contract, the future of the site from that perspective, the operations. Let those processes move independently, and if in the future we need to come back together as a work group, if something happens, there's an announcement, we can do that. But until that time, we're on indefinite pause. That would be our recommendation. So I'll pause there because we were created at the behest of this group and see if there's any thoughts or concerns with that type of recommendation.
Any comments from the commissioners? Any thoughts?
Good work.
Thank you. Oh, we have a...
Thank you, Linda Parlatt, State Senator. I would just like to thank Josh. I'll be up front. I did get contacted by a group that was interested in Alcoa, and rather than go to the work group because of their rapid response and the workers that we've heard from in the area, I connected with the key lobbyists, two of them in Olympia, and then they directly worked with Josh, and it turned out that this group, you know, it didn't fit, but those things might happen in the future. But I have to compliment Alcoa for, they really mean it. It's just curtailed right now. But I think it's so smart for this community to be thinking ahead. But thank you, Josh, for that and the entity, because I just wanted to get out of the loop but do it behind the scenes. And that might happen again in the future, but I just wanted to be upfront about that.
Commissioners, do you have a recommendation on the floor? Does anyone disagree with the approach or have a different approach? I'm seeing nods of consensus.
I guess. Don't we have a seminal moment next year in June of 2017? Is that a fish or cut bait sort of time, or is there going to be a potential delay beyond that?
I think it's probably a little earlier than that. Because the way the contract works, the plant would have to restart by that date, and restart probably would take a good 90 days to put into effect. So our expectation is that the company is going to need to finish the split. That's clearly the priority for the company right now, is accomplishing the split. That, if it happens in fourth quarter, would then put them in a position where there's a new leadership team in place, because Alcoa Corp will have a CEO and they'll be running the business. And they would focus on the question about what happens with Wenatchee Works. So we're kind of expecting in that January through March timeframe of next year that likely going to be the critical point for a decision on what's the future of the plant. And that reinforces the pause.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I certainly agree to a pause until then, and I think that might sharpen us a little bit. I'd like to, if we do move forward, I'd like to be proactive, and I just think that's a more aggressive approach, but we'll know more then. So I would agree with the pause, but certainly they've done a great job. I appreciate it, and I want to echo Commissioner Congdon's big thank you for all your work. So.
Other comments or questions from the commissioners?
Go ahead. I was just going to comment on the work that's been done through the workforce skill source, helping people getting engaged in other vocations and education. That was a key component for a number of individuals.
On the absence of any dissenting suggestions or opinions, the consensus is you're on pause. Thank you for the work.
So maybe one quick thing, a question that I thought might come up for Josh, not so much a PUD question, but a lot of these conversations with the other communities, the environmental remediation issue has certainly been a big concern, and you've been involved in those in other places. You know what a big deal that is. It's really more of a takeaway question, but it's the company's contractual commitment to environmental remediation as the split occurs. Who carries that responsibility? What company will carry that responsibility, and how does that work through? At this point, as I understand, the split hasn't even legally been defined yet, so it's probably not possible to answer that question today, but it is a really important question for this community. If you could just let folks know, it would be really helpful if we could get information back to the community about that.
I'll return back to you with an answer as soon as I have it.
Great.
Sure, you bet.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Tracy, we're going to do a Public Works Trust Fund before you sit down. Okay.
Why did he even bother?
Separate subject, Public Works Trust Fund. We have talked in the past about the value of the Public Works Trust Fund for our community. And a number of months ago, was it a year ago, we talked about working together, the three commissions, and figuring out if there's something we collectively could do to promote the interests of protecting the Public Works Trust Fund, the funding of it, the function of it. And so where we are now is going into the 2017 legislative session, there are a number of options probably. One is make sure there's funding. Another is to protect the fund. But in the event neither the funding in this program or the program itself goes away, there might be other ways to ensure that the function of the Public Works Trust Fund lives on. Either it's called something different or called the same thing itself. And so what we had been working on subsequent to the setting of the agenda for this is developing a statement about a desired outcome where staff and some of the commissioners would work together. So I've got a statement that I was going to read to see if it's something that this Tri-Commission would like staff to work towards. Working jointly with the Tri-Commission, develop a 2017 legislative strategy that results in a sustainable and reliable source of low-cost funding for local government infrastructure projects in Washington State. At the conclusion of the information gathering that we would work on together, and in time for the final Tri-Commission meeting of 2016, develop a final report and provide recommendations for making the fund sustainable and reliable, as well as a legislative strategy. So make sure we have access to funds, develop a legislative strategy, and prepare in 2017 to engage.
Comments, commissioners?
Mother eating apple pie.
The last meeting of the year will be the usual pre-legislative session get-together, late November, early December this year. We'll wait until after the general election. Commissioner Conner.
Don't mean to dominate, but so is the current Public Works Trust, has the current Public Works Trust fund been swept completely? No dollars remaining in the trust fund? I should know, but I'm not up to date on that.
No, the governor vetoed that portion of it last year. It's still alive, but there's a possibility it could be swept again this year. And it's just what could happen is the repayment on the funds could be swept one more time, and that would pretty much kill the fund.
Yep.
But I know at the board level, they've just hired a lobbyist, an independent lobbyist, to work for us, and that'll be very helpful. Someone who's very friendly and understands the fund and the history of the fund. And that Commerce is asking that the fund be process, the way it's looked at, be changed, and gear a little bit more towards housing.
That would be the
infrastructure for housing. Yeah,
that would be the change of process. That
could be one of the changes.
A different scope or a different focus. Is that
right? Right. But I think they're still looking to see what happened. Allison.
Well, I was going to say they did put out a call for applications.
They did. And thank you for doing that. I think Shalane do one also? Yeah, and we'll be looking at those at the next meeting. We actually, the Public Works Board has a retreat coming up in September, October.
Mr. Smith?
So the way I heard the statement that you read, it's an umbrella statement that potentially goes beyond the Public Works Trust Fund. It's not directed at the trust fund. It's directed at the result, and I like the statement you've made. So this actually could encompass the trust fund, could encompass something else.
That's right.
I think that's an important adjustment, and it's a good one, I think.
Okay.
Other comments?
I just have a question. Are you treating that as kind of a mission statement for your future lobbying? The reason I ask is this. If I don't know if this is typical, but it occurs to me that there is more strength in numbers. And so along with the other mayors, I would imagine that the cities would sign on to that as well in order to add strength to any proposal you come forward with. Certainly the city level.
Yeah, I think part of the strategy will be is who would be what would be the entities that would have similar interests. And you're right, there are strengths in numbers. So the more folks that would have a similar interest, I think the better, especially like the port has certain access to funds now, or they don't. But that might be one of the changes. So depending on where we land with the specific path forward, it would sure make sense for as the Tri-Commission develops the specific goals and the legislative strategy that we'd reach out to other folks.
And just as a comment, AWC, the PUD, Wapuda, and the counties have all been significant stakeholders and lobbying on our behalf for the last 3 years.
Yes, sir.
So what do you plan to have then for our last meeting with the legislators?
What I'd like to have is a better understanding of the lay of the land. I'd like to have a consensus between the people that are going to be working on this from each of the Tri-Commission organizations on what we would specifically like to see, and then a strategy for communicating that, either legislatively, having meetings, or whatever our strategy is, so that you know what it is we're getting, we know what the landscape is, and we know how we're going to go out and try to attain it.
Commissioner
and we would have that for the last meeting for them to say, yeah, go do it.
Okay. Any other comments or thoughts about that? Any disagreement? Seeing none, that's what we'll do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. So moving to updates, regulating marijuana growing operations in Chelan County. Commissioner Englund.
Just a quick comment about how we got to where we are right now. If you remember, upon passage of 502, we moved to approve growing, processing, and retail sales in Chelan County, based mainly on the fact that the Chelan County citizens voted in favor of that. As we moved forward, we were assured by people who strangely had very strong knowledge of something that they indicated they knew nothing about, and that was the growing of marijuana. We were assured that there was no smell issue that was any problem. The people, the neighbors, would not even know they were there. We came and we were assured by the state that they would work as partners with us and that it would be handled basically the same way that the Liquor Control Board worked with theirs. We found out quickly that none of those things came to fruition. They came very quickly that it might work out okay when there's 10 plants scattered out over an acre in order to hide them, but when you have 30,000 plants on that same acre, it doesn't work. And any of you that have thought for a while that skunks have moved back into your area, that's basically what marijuana smells like about the time it begins to bud out and wants to attract insects. It also smells about the same as that is as the processing goes on. What we have done, initially we moved to issue a moratorium based on the response of the neighbors, based on the response of the concern of property owners throughout the county. We went ahead, moved from that moratorium to a ban on the production and processing of marijuana to allow us time in order to set some kind of regulation. We fully expect that that industry will again be approved in the code, but what it'll look like is yet to be determined. We have formed a group that both pro and anti growing of marijuana to work together in the committee and to give us ideas and to give some proposals, and they worked surprisingly well. They worked a great, put in a number of hours in order to do that, gave recommendations that we have briefly looked at as commissioners. The process is that it goes next to the Planning Commission, at which time the Planning Commission will be given a kind of a draft code of how that would be drawn up. It addresses mainly whether this can be, and it appears that it can be controlled, moved indoors with carbon filters. There's also a discussion of possibility of location at extremely remote areas of being able to do that. It will address the issue of lights and the direction of that lights. We also, in the process of this, found that marijuana is also a tremendous user of power. And we had indicated to the PUD some of the concerns that we had stumbled across when we find the amount of power that indoor marijuana grow requires. We have the plan is to, I believe, this next month, the Planning Commission receives those drafts. They will discuss it and forward on to us then. It looks like toward the end of the year is what our goal is, to have something in place that would allow them, producers and processors, to go ahead and proceed. But as it is right now, it is a complete ban. We have, under advice of legal, they have been given 2 years to, if we cannot come up to an agreement, 2 years to phase their current operations out. Anyone who is not operating by the September 29th date is not operating legally. So we currently now have two code violations being processed to the point of that they would go directly to a hearings examiner. Anyone else that is also on the list will receive that also. If that process has not been completed or they decide not to follow the new rules, then those code processes will go on. We've been very disappointed with the lack of partnership from the state. We found out very quickly that they don't operate the same as the Liquor Control Board. They have been continuing to issue licenses through the whole process, through the moratorium, and through the outright ban. This gives the people that are applying the feeling that they are operating legally when they are not. They've made a brief statement at the bottom, but don't consider that a reason to local rules are not considered a reason to not issue the license. We found another number of cases where it's totally confusing as why that license would ever be issued on property they do not own, on in areas that are by the guidelines or not. Are not technically allowed, but we were assured that they have been instructed by the legislature and by the act that was enabling act that they were required to go ahead and do this, and it would take a legislative fix to change any of that, becomes more of our partners. It's to the point where if they are aware, excuse me, of an illegal grow operating right next to a licensed grow, that they will not even notify our sheriff of that condition. And so we hope by the end of December, sometime in December, to have the rules in place. So are there any questions that that would generate? Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Englund. Up next is Andy Wendell. The working group identified the high-density load rate as a topic of interest to the group, so Andy's here to report on that.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm excited to be here today to talk about a PUD reaching a major milestone in what's been considered a pretty big challenge for us at the PUD. I do have a brief presentation that I will go through relatively quickly here. Let's see. And for those of you that don't know me, my name is Andy Wendell. I'm the Director of Customer Service at Chelan PUD, heavily involved in policies and rates as they relate to our retail customers. Just to refresh everybody's memory about what we're talking about, the PUD has identified this new load class, new electric customer, as a high-density load, or HDL for short. So what is it and why does it matter to us? This is a new customer class that we've seen come into our service territory over the last 24 months. They use an intense amount of energy in a small area. They are very mobile, and they have the ability to connect anywhere in our service territory. What's important to recognize for this group is these HDL customers can locate in a residential setting, a commercial, or an industrial setting. So why does that matter to us? Well, to the PUD, if these customers are not sited properly and evaluated for their impact on the electric system, can cause some real serious significant problems to us. Not only that, the district has some financial models that were initially threatened. I'm happy to say that part of our resolution and our milestone recently, we've addressed those financial concerns. And just keep in mind that the electrical infrastructure is not finite. We do have some limitations to where we site these services. So, with that, I just wanted to use an example. Up on the screen here, you see over on the right-hand side is energy consumption. This is a particular residential service in our service territory, and you can see that it goes back to about 2013. The blue line is the actual energy consumption. The orange line is the average consumption. If we were to profile your residential homes, you'd probably see something very similar around the sub-2,000 kilowatt hour. But over here in 2015 in July, we saw something happen in this particular residential service. Their energy consumption literally went through the roof. That gives us great concern. This was a cryptocurrency mining operation in a residential setting. This happened to be an apartment complex, and had all five of the apartment complexes had this type of energy consumption, we likely would have seen a major failure, probably a fire, something of that nature. So when I talk about these folks locating their infrastructure or their services in residential, commercial, and industrial settings, it's very important for us as a community to make sure that we're citing them and evaluating those impacts appropriately. This is just an example. Many of you have probably seen this in other public presentations. This is a cryptocurrency mining operation. It's 9 foot by 3 foot by 2 foot. This particular installation uses the same amount of energy of about 73 residential homes over a one-year period, right? So very compact amount of energy. As you can see, it doesn't take much to set them. It just takes an electrical connection. This could be in an old packing shed. It could be in a garage. It could be in a mini storage, those types of things. Here's another example. We designed this transformer and service entrance equipment at the PUD to serve this mini storage facility. There was five different buildings here. One of them is not active. It was a future building. But the four, we designed the infrastructure to support that type of load. Well, what happened? In building D, we saw some cryptocurrency mining. Again, the usage went through the roof. Had all four of these buildings occupied by this type of load, we would have probably seen major failure. In this particular case, we did have to upsize the utility transformer to serve this facility. Just going back over history here, as you know, the PUD put a moratorium in place around December of 14. And you can see we were below 1 megawatt of power at that point in time. And even during the moratorium, these loads have increased to a total of over 6.6 average megawatts at this point in time. That's a significant amount of energy. So there is interest in this group of customers to grow. And again, the PUD has done quite a bit to mitigate those cost components, as well as new policies to address some of the siting issues. But as we move forward, if there was a takeaway, I would ask you folks, both in the county and the municipalities, is that we really want to partner with you to understand siting of these new customers in the service territory to make sure that we're installing safe, reliable services for them. Why are they coming here? We've seen this map. We call this the heat map. You see up here, the white is less than 5 cents a kilowatt hour. There's one spot on the map, Washington State, back to Chelan and Douglas counties, that show that. That's why these folks are coming here. So again, just to recap, we saw some risk both in our financial health, our operating, our system operations, and safety component. So this was the basis for change. So our mitigation actions at the PUD was to implement a moratorium, and we've had that in place, and it still is in place. Our milestone was establishing a new HDL rate and a rate classification. That's called the high density load. It's called rate schedule 35 for those of you that are interested. Today, that is planned to be in place January 1 of 2017. We've also established quite a few new application processes, new service regulations, and an upfront capital charge, all to help ensure that the infrastructure is in place for these customers to be safe and reliable. So I won't go through this other than there is a rate schedule that has been adopted through PUD resolution called the high density load. And essentially, where we've characterized these loads is that they use about 250 kilowatt hours per square foot per year or more, generally speaking, more. And this is the primary characteristic that sets them apart from other users. And you'll see down on the bottom, it refers to server farms. And that includes some of our existing data processing or server farms in our service territory. The rate itself, this is just kind of a breakdown of what it looks like. It is based on what we call a demand charge. And the demand charge is at $5.50 per kilowatt. So depending on the amount of energy a customer uses, they will see a different all-in rate at the end. In addition, there's a basic charge. The more energy you use, the larger the basic charge. That's pretty consistent with utility rate making. And In addition, there's this upfront capital fee at $190 per kW. So a new applicant coming into Chelan County that wishes to establish a high-density load would pay $190 per kilowatt as an upfront capital charge. So the recommended timeline right now, this update is part of a larger strategic outreach plan. We're engaging a number of different entities across the county, including each of the known HDL customers, Washington State Department of Labor and Industries, the Realtors Association, the IBEW local workers, as well as the electricians community. We'll be doing that between now and the end of the year to make sure that we've answered any questions. We've informed people of the new rate and the new policies associated with that and the application processes. Come this October, we hope that our Board of Commission will consider some options around lifting the moratorium towards the latter part of the year. Right now, we're talking about trying to develop a queue to try to understand the level of interest for new customers coming into this HDL arena. So with that, we've got lots of information on our website at www.chelanpud.org. Lots of public input. On behalf of the PUD staff, I want to say that I recognize a lot of people in the crowd today that have participated and provided the PUD great input on this important topic. If it wasn't for you, we probably wouldn't be here where we are today. But so thank you on behalf of the PUD staff for your input on this very important topic. If you have any questions, I can answer them now, or you can contact me offline at another time.
Thank you, Andy. Any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Walter.
So Doug mentioned the marijuana and the likelihood of indoor grows and the demand there. Do you have statistics on the draw and the demand for those types of operations?
Sure, I can briefly talk about that. We have monitored and evaluated grow operations and their energy consumption both indoors and outdoors. It's true that they do use a lot of energy. It is quite a different profile of energy. Contrary to the HDL customers, they have what we call a high load factor, which they use an intense amount of energy 24/7, 365. The grow operations is quite a bit of a different profile. Depending on where the plant is and its maturity, it's using a different amount of light and thus a different amount of energy. We do have concern over the grow operations. Very similar to the HDL customers, we see grow operations in residential, commercial, and industrial and rural settings. Rural settings gives us greater concern because the lines to serve the customers at the end of the Eniac Valley are much smaller. They have much less capacity. So there's much more of an impact with the grow operation in those areas. We're looking at that very closely. We're putting studies together. I would say that for this group, what is important to the PUD, very similar to the HDL customers, is that we want to work with your planners and your folks that are processing permits for occupancy to ensure that those folks are talking to the PUD before they're setting up operations, and we've had a chance to evaluate the infrastructure that serves them to make sure that it's safe and reliable. Does that answer your question?
So have you had conversations with our planning department as they're developing this process that we're going to be considering?
We've had very limited conversations at this point in time. Our aspirations are to bring those groups together as well as the municipalities that are out there as well to have those discussions. Both on the HDL side and the grow operation side is to think about these from an application requirement, requiring those applicants to not only talk to you, but also talk to the PUD as part of that process. Very similar, Commissioner Walter, very similar to I see the development application process where there's an opportunity for the agencies to weigh in on the development and the impact. We would also like the opportunity to weigh in on HDL and grow operations impacts.
Any other questions or comments? Mayor Gomes.
How does this plan affect existing HDL users?
That's a great question. Thank you for bringing that up. So we believe we know all of the HDL customers in our service territory. Some of them, like I showed on the monitor, are very small. Some of them are very large. And we have been working towards talking with all of them. Some of the larger ones that have made significant capital investments, we're working with them on a transitional period to bring them into the new rate structure over a defined period of time to help them migrate from their current rate into the future rate. So we've got some communications going on right now with some of those larger entities at this point in time. Other ones will see the new rate increase as soon as January 1.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Okay. Next up, impact of the energy market decline on PUD revenue. Steve Wright.
So I think I'm going to take this conversation topic a little bit broader and just talk about how things have changed relative to our strategic plan. Our strategic plan was built around our financials, which 3 years ago were a very rosy forecast in terms of both revenues and expenses and the opportunity to produce a substantial amount of net revenue out through probably the 2020s. And yet at the same time, we also looked at what happens if things go bad. So it was prepare for good times, prepare for bad times. The bad news is we mostly had things go downhill from 3 years ago. So the market in particular, where 80% of our revenue comes from, was in free fall in 2015, and we lost a substantial amount of forecasted revenue. If you look at a comparison of where we were back then to where we are now, it's a little bit less than $1 billion through the 2020s of reduced revenue. On the other hand, our costs have risen. So we've had more problems with our assets than we had forecasted, in part because we decided to focus on asset management and really go in and look at the state of our assets and try to make sure that we had them in a position that they could last for a long time. So we now have about $250 million of costs that we did not have when we finished the strategic plan a few years ago. Recall that the strategic plan had three key elements in terms of how we would use those surplus revenues. Number one, to reinvest in our assets. Number two, to accomplish debt reduction. And number three, to initiate a public power benefit program. And the public power benefit program would start in the mode of crawl before you walk and walk before you run to see if we actually did produce the kind of revenue that we had predicted. That was the protection against things going bad. So as we prepare for the 2017 budgets, as we put these together, we continue to be very focused on reinvesting in the assets because that's what creates the long-term value for the community. We did make a $22 million debt reduction payment this year, and we continue to forecast that we have the capability to produce the revenue to be able to make future debt reduction payments. Our goal had been to be below a 35% debt-to-equity ratio, and we continue to think we can achieve that goal. But this past summer, when we did choose to make a $60 million investment to rehabilitate the oldest units on the system, the B1 through 4 at Rock Island, we had a conversation with our board and said, depending on how things go, we may or may not make all of the accelerated debt repayments in that 2019 timeframe. So we'll have to see how things play out, but we can not make those and still hit our 35% debt-to-equity ratio. And then third, on the public power benefit element, that it's more likely that we're going to be in the continuing to crawl mode than moving toward walking and running because we just don't have as much revenue as we once thought. So that's fundamentally it. Again, we believe we can implement the strategic plan as originally laid out, maybe not as robustly as originally hoped, but those key elements we continue to believe that we will be able to support, and the budgets we're putting together for 2017 continue to focus on that. And I just say I hope that we don't take any more big financial blows here in the near future. I do want to finish by saying that on an expected value basis, this utility is still in great shape relative to utilities around the rest of the country. Not as in as good a shape as we forecast a few years ago, but I'd still take our position against just about any other utility in the country. Any questions about that?
Where are you at right now in your debt to equity?
A little bit below 45%. Kelly, is that right?
The goal is 35.
Yeah, and the goal is to get below 35. Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Steve. Expanded Pangborn Airport runway reopening. Trent Moyers.
I'm going to beat Steve on presentation time. That was pretty quick, but I can do a lot better. We're done. It's kind of a monumental occasion for us. The runway extension project is, for all intents and purposes, finished. There's a few little things that still need to happen. The FAA's got a flight check that they need to do. The contractors got to come out in October and do some reseeding and a little bit of regrading. But for all intents and purposes, the runway extension project is complete. It's been a long time coming to get here. But we're here now, and I'll take questions if you've got them. And if you've got questions about nonstop service to Honolulu, Craig's here to answer those questions. So that's really next on our list of things to do. Is we've got this long runway. What are we going to do with it? We're looking to try to add additional service. So we'll be working on that. The other thing that's happening out at the airport, I'll tell you right now, is the master plan update. We have a kickoff meeting tomorrow with our Public Advisory Committee, and that'll be about a 12 to 18 month process to see where the airport ends up over the course of the next 20 years. So that's where what's happening out at the airport.
Well, I just want to thank you guys. This is a $30 million project, and you guys have come in, you know, on budget, on time, done a great job. Another thing, and I have to give credit to the previous commission at the port. You guys did a lot of work. We are now the fastest growing regional airport in the state of Washington. We are adding a great percentage of employments where many of the markets are declining. We are looking at other markets in a variety of ways in collaboration with some of the other folks at the table here, trying to reach perhaps a couple of markets, hopefully with, perhaps even the Bay Area and perhaps Portland. And I think you need to, if you can, talk a little bit about that. But those are the sorts of opportunities that come because of the extension, and then maybe even some leisure stuff with Allegiant.
Sure, yeah. There's some things that we couldn't have done beforehand with the runway length at 5,700 feet that now the 7,000 feet affords us to do, and actually have real conversations with airlines about service to some other destinations. And as Rory mentioned, we're talking about the Bay Area. Salt Lake is a possibility, Portland, and then from a leisure travel, the Vegas and Phoenix, those are markets that we couldn't get to now with the fleet that we couldn't get to previously with the type of aircraft that could utilize the airport. So now we're talking folks that fly longer range aircraft, and we can have those conversations with them on a, like I said, a more real basis that it's a possibility, whereas before it was always hypothetical. So those conversations will be taking place very aggressively on our part to try to see what we can do to get some additional service. I mean, we hear the demand for it on a regular basis from the traveling public. The destination isn't always Seattle. It's always, I've got to go to Seattle to connect to somewhere else, and we're trying to help out those folks to get there one stop instead of, or nonstop instead of making that one stop in Seattle. You have a question?
You both answered my question.
Oh, awesome.
And good answer. Yeah. I like it.
Other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you, Trent. Icicle Creek Comprehensive Water Resource Strategy, Commissioner Daner.
Well, the Icicle, how did you say that? Comprehensive Water Resource Strategy. It's an Icicle work group, for short. But, you know, one thing about that, the whole process, is that it's a microcosm of a societal paradigm shift. And the Icicle Creek watershed had reservoirs installed. When I say installed, they were actually built about 100 years ago. And it was done because it provided a necessary water resource for the Wenatchee Valley. And it was done as a result of a drought in 1921. And so, you know, as I said, it's getting close to 100 years. At that time, it was critical for the growers to have water. It also, provided you know, a much needed resource to even the communities. So when you start with this water work group, and the reason it was formed is because there were a number of groups that were litigating as to, well, a number of things. One was around the fish hatchery. The city of Leavenworth had a suit with the Department of Ecology. There was a couple other fish groups that were concerned about the in-stream flows and the icicle. And there was only one party that could bring anything to the table to help solve that issue, and that was the icicle irrigation. And they had the water rights that were established back in the 20s. And so what they are in the process of doing is repairing their facilities. And between the icicle irrigation and the National Fish Hatchery, who also has some water rights to snow lakes, they have the ability to put more water in the stream, either by management practices or by refurbishing their facilities, which would hold the water longer in the higher elevations. Now, the difficulty in getting that message across, and where I go back to my paradigm shift, is that what you're dealing with right now are really not the rights that were established, but what the rights that people have become empowered with. And so when you have an environmental group that says, the government created an Alpine Lakes wilderness, and that was for the people. Well, it was done at the agreement of the icicle irrigation, who owned the lakes that were in the wilderness. So, you know, the federal government entered into contractual arrangements with the irrigation district to allow them to do what they needed to do to continue to access the water and to discharge it in a meaningful fashion for the growers. And yet now what we're really doing is dealing with outside groups that have, you know, a sense of empowerment that this is their wilderness. And, you know, the wilderness is there for public use, but what they don't understand, of course, is pre-existing conditions. So the Icicle Water Group is working, to resolve some of those issues. And what was interesting is that everyone was at the table initially. They all said, okay, we'll put down our interest right now so that we can have a collaborative group. But in the process, we've lost two of those members already because they really have committed to litigating no matter what the issue is. So the current status right now is they're working on a programmatic EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement, to just get input on what is being proposed. And there are a number of issues that may be addressed, and there are a number of solutions that are being proposed. But this is a general environmental impact statement that people have an opportunity to weigh in. Now, the benefit, should this play out the way we would like to see, is it was really to the cities of Leavenworth and Cashmere, to the growers in the Wenatchee Valley, and that means all the way from Leavenworth down to Monitor, because the icicle irrigation ditch goes down to Fairview Canyon, and then also the Peshastin Irrigation District benefits from that too. And, you know, when you a lot of these people think, oh, it's just those growers, you know, they're not very efficient with their systems. And what we've proven throughout the course of this dialogue is that, you know, growers have been very efficient in the way they've managed their practices. You know, in the old days there was real irrigation, and you didn't, you know, really monitor your water that well. And now we're down to where, you know, whether it's micrometers or piezometers, I mean, you know what kind of water usage is happening in your orchard, and that's just the way, you know, growers are doing it. And from the standpoint, it's interesting that people on the west side, they really feel like those people in Leavenworth use too much water on their lawns. And you try and explain to them, well, you know, the water pattern here, the rainfall in eastern Washington is not like it is in western Washington. And yes, it does dry out in Seattle in the summer too, but that whole lack of understanding of the uniqueness of the different geographic areas of our state is really a difficult hurdle to overcome. But in the process, we've had, like four meetings over in Seattle to make it more accessible for these people to come. And as they come and as they learn what has happened, what has been in place, It's a little bit mind-boggling that it's so difficult to help people understand that not everyone is trying to take advantage of the natural resources that are there. It's actually being done in a way that really is greatly beneficial to the aquatics, because we'll have more in-stream flows, Well, it's more beneficial to the growers because they will have more predictability, and the water rights that are interruptible will not have to be interruptible. And from the domestic use, it provides water for people. So this summer, one of the unique things that is happening, we've actually hired people to run up to the lakes. There's five lakes that are involved. And they're monitoring the discharges to really quantify how much water is coming out of those lakes in what time frame. And it's kind of neat for some of these young guys. They literally are running up to the lakes and getting paid for it. So it's a very exhaustive process. It's a very scientific process. And it's being very well done, in my opinion. So that's kind of our update.
Keith, I have a question. You know, you've done a lot of work on the source and the storage. How much work has the water group done on the delivery system that goes down both sides of the Wenatchee Valley, the ditches that are in place today?
What work in what way?
Well, is there discussions as far as piping the water, changing the way it's delivered, that kind of a discussion, or are you just talking about the
No, that. Yes, that's very much a part of it. I mean, the efficiency of the delivery. And the Cascade Orchards Irrigation Company, they are it's Trout Unlimited that's working with them on piping their system. Mm-hmm. So that would create, you know, more water in the icicle prior to the hatchery. So that's one beneficial project that's been being explored. As far as the icicle and the Peshastin, they've done a tremendous amount of work through the years, as I'm sure you're aware, in putting the ditch in pipe where it's feasible. But there are some benefits of having that open ditch. And so where you have it, most of it is concrete lined so that you haven't lost as much to seepage and all. But the delivery has been a very much a focal point, too.
Okay. Great.
You know, the questions for Commissioner Gaynor? Thank you, Keith. The final presenter is Dan Frazier, reporting on the PUD's long-range facilities planning effort.
Close it again. I'm sorry. I'll just shut you down. I'll let you take it. Then.
Well, you've got to focus on my first slide for about the last 20 minutes, so I think I'll stay there for a minute. I'm Dan Frazier. I'm the Director of Shared Services for Shoreland PUD, and I'm representing a larger group of employees at the district that are taking a look at the entire stock of support facilities at the PUD. So we're not talking about the hydros themselves, but all of the facilities that support the larger PUD effort. The nexus of this was really a quick study that was done back in 2015. It looked at 16 of our facilities, kind of the most heavily used of those facilities. And what came out of that study was that just to maintain what we have, we were going to spend nearly $90 million over the next 30 years just to maintain what we had. And that was kind of eye-opening for the district because you look at, we actually have 53 structures that we're looking at in this plan. You look at that and say, well, if we're spending 90 for that, is there another way to spend that money, a better way to spend that money? So that's what culminated in this strategic facilities plan. Our motto on a lot of what we're doing, and Mr. Wright continues to remind us, it's the best for the most for the longest. So we are looking at this from a very financial view. We have three scopes of work that we are focusing on. The first is called Scope A. It's the downtown, and we don't just mean Fifth Street. We mean everybody that is located in the greater Wenatchee area. So we have the downtown, which is on the top there. That's the Fifth Street campus. We have the Holly Street campus, and although many people may not know the amount of work that goes on there, it's a huge operations center for the district, and it comprises about 16 buildings on that site. Our fiber operations are located there. If you see the big warehouse area and all the stock, working stock for the distribution is in that area. And then, of course, this building, the CTC. This was the last time that the district actually expanded its building stock was when we participated with the port in constructing this facility, and we are located, we have two or three of our operational units located in this building. So Scope A was to look at, are we doing it the right way? Is there a better way to deploy the way we're working? On the top picture there, if you see the bigger of the, I actually have a pointer here. This building right here is our line operations and warehouse, and those are all those trucks you see going out Wenatchee Avenue every morning, sometimes stuck in traffic, sometimes stuck on the way back in. there's got to be a better way to deploy those people out into the rest of the county without being stuck kind of in the middle of the city. So that's part of what we're looking at in Scope A. Scope B is our central maintenance, which is located at Rocky Reach Dam. It's really all these buildings, kind of this corridor through here. These are some support buildings for the work that goes on in the dam on the construction or contract basis. But I think I just turned everything off. It also includes all these, there's some small buildings down here, storage, yard, and other operations. So we're looking at how those facilities function in support of the dam. And then finally, our Scope C was the maintenance and support of Rock Island Dam. And this is an interesting one for us because we have lots of land on the Chelan County side. Powerhouse 1 is really close to the Douglas County side. We have a small operation over here, and then Powerhouse 2 is closer to the Chelan County side. And we have employees that cross the dam multiple times a day when they're working on different areas of the dam to get to their support facility. So we knew there was some opportunity there. Really, our methodology in doing this is we've tried to look at what's the best scenario, we put these packages together, scenario for the district, both financially and in terms of other values, our value of safety and trustworthiness, our stewardship of our resources. And so we eventually developed these four or five scenarios. Scenario zero being the what are we doing now and how much would it cost to really just keep doing that forever, or at least for 50 years. And so we know what those costs are. We're just really informing that. And that's going to be the baseline for decision-making. Scenario one is what if we did some modest improvements, improved our efficiency at each of the locations, hopefully took care of some of that cross-deck traffic that we talked about on the Rock Island, maybe do something with the line operations so they're not stuck in Wenatchee traffic, some of those little modest improvements. Scenario two is let's stay at our facilities, but let's make the big long-term investment. New facilities cost less to run. But we don't want to look at changing the way we operate necessarily, just stay where we are at. Scenario three, which was the operations and service center concept, where we would take the most heavily traveled groups that leave the area, leave the downtown core, and get them kind of on the north end of town where they're closer to the go up the valley or go up the river and kind of cut down some of that travel time and create an operations and service center in the north end, but still keep the downtown presence. And then finally, scenario four, which was a let's just put the whole district support system of, and this is only a Scope A option, put them together in one facility. So we have administration, operations, all in one facility. That's about a 20-acre campus to do that. So there was a lot of how do we even do that to move forward. So when we started working through these scenarios, it became very obvious that the financial impacts are huge. Over a 50-year period, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And so we've slowed down our process of evaluating outcomes, and now we're actually trying to inform more completely the financial picture that we're looking at. So we're looking at all different types of financial implications, productivity losses from those crews being kind of isolated, productivity gains from getting groups together that are currently located at different facilities. We're looking at all kinds of travel analysis to see how many times do people in this building go downtown for meetings? How many times do I go out here? So let's look at all those things that could be made a lot better if we were all at one location. So the next steps we're taking are basically to get that completion of the financial analysis, we'll get that back to our internal stakeholders, and over the next several months, we'll be evaluating those impacts as well as the future impacts to all the other operations, and then we'll be bringing forward to the board a recommendation for a direction forward. Any questions?
Questions for Dan? Okay, thank you, sir.
Thanks.
We are at the end of our time. Any last comments from the commissioners before we wrap it up? Mr. Smith is headed towards Kyrgyzstan tomorrow, so safe travels. Wait for the stories when he gets back.
He's going to be fighting goats, right, or something like that?
Pardon?
Fighting goats?
Dead ones. Dead ones.
Well, thank you all.
Sorry, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. And the next meeting will be either late November or early December.
Oh, yeah. I need goats.
I need those.